Let's welcome Anne and Richard for our talk, Policing the Romantic Crowd. Please give them a warm round of applause. Thank you.
Jochen Valjaun. Croeso I chi gyd, and I bet there's only one in the audience who just understood what I said. That was a warm welcome to you in Welsh, and it's really great to hear so many different languages here on the 30C3. Now, that's where we are, in Aberystwyth. That's 20 kilometres north of the only place in Europe where civilian and military drones can be tested in civilian airspace, and that's crucial for future policing techniques with drones in high-density environments. We're also 50 kilometres north of the town where Manning went to school when he was a teenager. So we are at the periphery of Europe, but also at the heart of some of its major debates. So that's a perfect example then, I would say, for Deleuze's and Guattari's theory of the rhizome of non-hierarchical entry points into culture. And actually, in our talk, we're going to bring some of these entry points into creative apposition. So since first we drafted this paper, in both Germany and the UK, we have seen major examples of crowd activism. Here in Hamburg last weekend and earlier this month in London, where amazingly all three elements of our talk, policing, the romantic crowd, came together spectacularly. This was the scene in London, where thousands of students were protesting against police presence on university campuses. And Richard was especially pleased to see a romantic book, Mary Wollstonecraft, A Vindication of the Rights of Women, 1792, among the book shields carried by book block, not black block, but book block. Okay. So this reminds us that a powerful rhetorical tradition of civil liberties and gender equality has its roots in the romantic art and poetry.
Yeah, but our point isn't that romanticism has already had all the insights into surveillance culture, the culture of the nose. That said, it does appear that the romantics saw the internet coming. Okay, maybe not the internet, but certainly peer networks of communication based on trust. Now, we have to be careful about distinguishing between mere analogies linking the romantic period to our own age that maybe don't have any useful analogues, and those that do have some continued operational relevance. Because it is the case that writers, romantic writers like John Keats, Mary Shelley, William Wordsworth, philosophically modelled and to some extent thought through many of the debates and issues that we're currently having as we seek to shape the contours of our future societies. Now, these writers lived in the age that first imagined total surveillance. This is the age of Jeremy Bentham's Panopticon, published in 1791. So at the very least, it's valuable to remind ourselves where some of our ideas about surveillance and privacy and crowds, and particularly the policing of rhetorical and discursive space, have come from. So we're going to go on a journey into the romantic crowd, what in romantic slang was called the push, a bit like the coffee schlanger outside Saal 1. And along the way, we'll be meeting romantic poet John Keats, a couple of dandies riding velocipedes, a certain Victor Frankenstein, and two crowds that managed to be in the same place at once. Okay, so spring 1819, and German cutting-edge technology arrives in Britain in the form of Karl Dreiss's Laufmaschine. Now, these velocipedes were popular among the romantic geeks of the day, well-dressed dandies like these two, very eager to try out new gadgets, although the rudimentary steering mechanism sent many of them into hedges or tumbling into duck ponds. John Keats, in a letter from March 1819, dismissed this new technology. "The nothing of the day," he said, "is a machine called the velocipede. It is a wheel carriage to ride cockhorse upon, They will go 7 miles an hour. A handsome gelding will come to 8 guineas. However, they will soon be cheaper unless the army takes to them. So Keats is ridiculing Dreyse's invention as the nothing of the day. But that word nothing disguises an anxiety, a techno-ethical anxiety, anticipating that the army would take to them. Keats, who is part of a circle of anti-government activists, is worried about potential military applications.
Well, not quite like this. The design of the first police motorbike from 1818, and certainly not like this. This is Megacity One's take on the velocipede, but nonetheless, the potential revolution in policing techniques. Now, Keats wasn't the only one to worry about the army taking to them. On September the 1st, 1819, a popular magazine called The Tickler, they had great names back then, it conjured up a vision of an entire corps of velocipedites, or dandy dragoons. And here they are, riding cannons. So apologies to the stream about the readability. So such corps might be very useful for home service, particularly on the occasion of public spectacles. What the Tickler is talking about here is policing demonstrations. But that date, 1st of September 1819, is actually significant. It was just 2 weeks after mounted police riding real horses and armed with sabers had brutally dispersed 60,000 protesters on St. Peter's Field in Manchester. That was the infamous Peterloo Massacre. 15 people were slashed or trampled to death and hundreds wounded. One eyewitness was so appalled, he founded a new liberal newspaper called the Manchester Guardian, today just the Guardian. But for all the humor, the Tickler's actually suggesting that a corps of dandy dragoons, police on velocipedes, could control crowds without crushing people. And it adds by the same token that if the head of a dandy charger was shot off, the rider could simply, quote, nail it back on again. It's another absurd image, but it pulls the velocipede into the frame of a techno-ethical debate about the policing of public space. Now, in 1819, the velocipede, cheap, lightweight, and fast, looked like becoming part of the technology of domestic crowd control and post-Napoleonic expansion. As the Gentleman magazine predicted, echoing Keats, the velocipede is one of those machines which may probably alter the whole system of society because it is applicable to the movement of armies. As it turned out, the velocipede didn't catch on. Not for another 40 years until pedals were finally invented. The point, though, is that the Romantics were quick to model their impact ethically and on Britain's fraught political landscapes.
So no one, of course, reads The Tickler anymore, but maybe they should, because the magazine's whimsical take on fashionable new machines in 1819 actually hides an acute and sophisticated response to the Peterloo Massacre, and, of course, to all potential misuses of technology. And it's as radical in its own way as Percy Shelley's better-known response to Peterloo, the poem The Mask of Anarchy was, and here's a stanza from it. And it celebrates the energies of the crowd by seditiously summoning another crowd into existence. Let a vast assembly be, and with great solemnity declare with measured words that ye are as God has made ye, free. Okay, so it's not a piece of high abstraction. Actually, it's a crowd pleaser made up of slogans. And Shelley even manages to anticipate one of Occupy's own slogans about the 99%, ye are many and they are few. But let's not forget this is rhetorical space, and actually how large public meetings in physical space were to be understood legally was crucial. For the Manchester authorities, the Peterloo crowd represented a single multi-headed monster. And that partly explains why the mounted police were able to charge into the crowd and attack them indiscriminately. If you were there, you were guilty. And it's the same logic behind today's kettling techniques, and we saw that last weekend here in Hamburg. Incidentally, the official position on the breaking up of the Rota Flora demo, as you can see here, was that, quoting the official police spokesman, the protesters suddenly started marching, and this was not what we agreed with them, so we had to stop the march. And the very same reason was given for breaking up the Peterloo meeting in 1819. As one government prosecutor explained at the trial of one of the organisers, Henry Hunt, the protesters were all provided with banners and advanced with a firm military step, presenting every appearance of troops upon their march. And ever since the French Revolution, actually, that fear of marching crowds has never really gone away. It's always there beneath the surface. Now, actually, Romantic literature was fascinated by the idea of crowds as potentially government-toppling monsters, including the most famous Romantic novel of all, one of the most famous novels, Mary Shelley's Frankenstein. Now, Frankenstein was published in 1817, and that's 2 years before Peterloo, but these were already riotous times, regularly punctuated by enormous gatherings of 60 to 80,000 people protesting against the high price of bread, loss of jobs to machines, and corrupt politicians. So as we all know, Victor Frankenstein is working at the limits or beyond the limits of romantic techno-ethics. He creates a monstrous creature, and then when he sees what he's done, he immediately disowns it. And the novel was straight away recognized in its own day as an allegory on techno-ethics, on the dangers of new scientific techniques, such as galvanism. But it was also recognized as an allegory on the political relationship between a dissatisfied and underrepresented people and their uncaring rulers. And the creature's complaint that he'd been betrayed by the father figure, by Frankenstein, is also the complaint of the underprivileged crowd protesting at their treatment by the state. But it doesn't end well for Frankenstein's creature, right? And the first thing that radical lawyers after Peterloo did, and these were not secret trials, as Chelsea Manning's was, we've just heard, in Saal 1, but these were public show trials. The first thing they did was to build their clients' defense cases around an agent-based rather than a flow model of crowd dynamics. And as one romantic attorney insisted, a person's presence at a riot did not in itself prove riotous behavior. Quoting from the trial records, the third and last charge was seditious riot. What was riot? There was no such thing as riot in the abstract. The individual must be found actually rioting. Even if a multitude was riotous, a man could not be made a rioter, even if present, if he was found holding no participation in the tumult that prevailed.
Now, such arguments won the day, as can be seen in the current UK Police Manual of Guidance on Public Order Policing. This is the theory anyway. And reading from the manual, as with any crowd, the protest crowd is not a homogeneous mass, but a collection of groups and individuals who, while sharing the same voluntary participation within the crowd, may wish to express themselves in different ways. So how one understood interaction within crowds in the Romantic period was crucial. It could mean the difference between freedom and the scaffold. And the questions Romantics ask themselves about crowds are the same as computer vision asks itself now. Questions about how crowd forms or how information was transmitted across them, whether behavior could be accurately predicted, and whether crowds were collective entities or made up of individuals. The agent-based modeling techniques, such as the social force model, appear to have settled some of these. They've transformed subdomains of surveillance, such as event detection and group tracking. And it turns out one of the keys to accurately predicting and interpreting human interaction within high-density environments is velocity. So if we look at these pictures D to F here, the decelerating subject, that's the one with the shortening blue arrow, produces attractive force as he approaches a stationary group. Deceleration indicates affiliation, or in romantic terms, sympathy. Because as Mary Fairclough has shown, romantic activists regard the movement of information across crowds as an instinctive flow of sympathy. The authorities, on the other hand, saw this propagation of data as contagion. Modern visual analysis uses the phrase attractive force to describe the relationship between people, which sounds neutral. However, those romantic terms, sympathy or contagion, depending on your political outlook, are still there beneath the surface. As you slow down, you give up social information, purpose, which the algorithm then passes either as normal or abnormal. But of course, such terms are ideologically freighted. For example, does the data set here, from left to right, show escape, panic, or could it depict beginnings of a flash mob? And how much interaction in crowds is normal anyway? Clearly, spatial context is crucial, but even here, the researchers' assumptions aren't neutral. And this quotation shows, in a normal scene of a stock market, the interaction force of stockbrokers would be quite higher than the interaction forces of walking pedestrians in a street scene. Now, for most people, there's nothing normal about the scene of a stock market. But what's more, the binary grouping of normal and abnormal in these much-used data sets, they're actually from Getty Images, is very revealing. In the category normal crowd scenes, we find pedestrian walking. Is there any other kind, I wonder? And marathon running. And under abnormal, we find crowdfunding and protesters clashing. But public protest isn't abnormal. It's, of course, part of the democratic process. Now, today's SFM multi-object tracking techniques don't only predict where objects and groups moving through crowds are going to be, but they also predict where people have been. And this is potentially really scary. Quoting the paper, trajectory estimation explains the whole past as if it had always existed. We can follow a trajectory back in time to determine where a pedestrian came from when he first stepped into view. Now, in this brave, new, statistically plausible world, it's possible to exist in two pasts simultaneously. One question immediately arises then. To what extent will surveilled subjects in the future be held accountable for their estimated past movements?
And it turns out that the Romantics worried about precisely this question. So to finish, the last 5 minutes, we want to show you a Romantic data set of crowd interaction, and one that powerfully explores the psychological impacts of projecting somebody backwards into an estimated trajectory. And it's a good example of how Romantic literature and art opens a space of shared imagination that's still available to us now. So London, 13th of September, 1819. 4 weeks after Peterloo, 2 weeks after that tickler article, and 1 o'clock in the afternoon. Two political processions are about to take place. The first is enormous. It's up to 300,000 people, possibly the largest Romantic crowd ever. And they've gathered to cheer the activist Henry Hunt on his way back into London to stand trial for treason for his part in organising Peterloo. And his supporters are calling it Hunt's triumphant entry into London. The second crowd is also enormous, and it's filled with dark shadows and suspicions. And that crowd is accompanying Christ into Jerusalem. And for one man that day, our poet John Keats, both processions are taking place at the same time. So it's the largest gathering in London ever at that date. Odd then that Keats hardly mentions it in his letter. Here's the letter. He writes to his brother and sister-in-law, "You will hear by the papers of the proceedings at Manchester, Peterloo, and Hunt's triumphal entry into London. I will merely mention that it is calculated 30, he means 300,000 people were in the street. As I pass Colnaghi's window, I saw a profile portrait of Zant, the destroyer of Kotzebue. His very look must interest everybody in his favour. That's all he says, nothing about the banners or the flags. And actually, he's more interested in this portrait of Zant. And the year before, in 1818, Karl Zant had stabbed the distinguished dramatist Kotzebue after accusing him of betraying the nation. So two crowds, one real, one a painting. And in that painting, Christ's triumphal entry into Jerusalem, we find Keats's face, painted by his one-time friend, Benjamin Robert Hayden. Now, the painting hasn't been exhibited at the time Hunt's procession takes place, but Keats is very familiar with the painting. He's seen it propped up in Hayden's dining room, where it's been the backdrop to many radical dinners, absorbing some of those radical energies and perhaps some of the atmosphere of suspicion. And by August 1819, Hayden's relationship with Keats has disintegrated. For the painter, Keats is an opportunist who's only using the activist networks as a way to get his work out in the radical press. But perhaps you've already noticed that Keats is the only person speaking in the crowd. There he is alongside other famous faces, Voltaire, Newton, Wordsworth. Keats is in green. He's the only one talking because he's found himself cast by Hayden, who's fallen out with him by now, in the role of the infiltrator, the whisperer, the betrayer, the agent provocateur. In short, within the allegory of the painting, as Judas himself. So as Keats stands around the London crowds, looking at Hunt supporters and seeing Christ's, he must have felt uncomfortable. Hayden's painting itself becomes a parable of the reform movement closing in on itself, of political friendship straining under the pressures of surveillance, and of what happens when social confidence breaks down. So when Keats tells us in the letter that he doesn't feel part of the crowds, it's because he's standing in two crowds at once, like many of us today. He's a quantum Keats, a Keats who disturbs our sense of historical narrative, a double exposure, a double agent. That face in the print shop window of Zant and his victim Kotzebue must have brought home to Keats and mediated the still fraught dyadic identities of friend and betrayer, activist and spy. And finally then, in many ways, that painting of Hayden's is one of Romanticism's most profound and moving reflections on the personal and interpersonal damage caused by surveillance culture. We'll leave it there. Thanks for listening.
Well, thank you very much. Do we have questions from the internet? I hear no. If you have questions in this room, could you please walk up to the microphones in the room here to so we can record your questions and answers?
Don't be shy.
Yes, please. Go ahead.
Hello. A question just now. My knowledge of the Romantic movement is not really extensive, but I do associate it also with a fear of technology, and not necessarily with crowds, but with individuality. And I wonder if you could just elaborate a little bit about the notion of Frankenstein, which is often read as a sort of, well, a call to engage responsibly with technology, and also with a broader sense of romantic distrust of crowds. Right, where it's precisely the big groups of people in which you lose your individuality. And as a result, you get this traditional romantic heroes alone in nature without an iPod. You know.
It's a fantastic question, and you're absolutely right. I mean, in a sense, the orthodox, until recently, the orthodox view of Romanticism is that it is a period of you know, the emergence of the individual genius, like the great romantic solitary genius, who, usually a man, is really just a conduit or a hollow bone for inspiration to travel down onto the page. And the romantic, you know, hero emerges with a fragment, all he can grasp from the great infinite. I say that's the orthodox. Actually, that's been challenged, and we now have a much more nuanced sense of romanticism as a period of coterie, of circles of writers gathering together. So, you know, the idea that Keats, for example, is a poet of autumn who sort of floats over the earth, having cut himself free, a transcendental figure who writes about, you know, the great eternal themes of beauty and truth and music. In actual fact, he's friends with a man, Lee Hunt, who served 2 years in prison for insulting the Prince Regent. He called him a fat Adonis of 50. Fortunately, he survived prison, but that's what the state did to him. Keats wrote a sonnet celebrating his release from prison. Now, the first thing he did was try to get an introduction, and part of the Aegon between Haydon and Keats is that Haydon was really the conduit into this radical circle of poets. Keats very quickly left Haydon to one side and sided with Lee Hunt, because Lee Hunt had a newspaper and published Keats. So it is a period of coteries. But the whole thing about the crowd, it's also a time when the crowd is gathering to itself, a sense of group agency. You know, after all, it was the crowd that sort of wreaks havoc through France. It's what the British authorities are frightened of. And that's why, as soon as they have hints that the Peterloo crowd is drilling as a military force, they're very scared and they send in the police and they disperse them beautifully. But it's a great question.
Yeah, maybe a little bit of an anecdote first. Actually, the murder of Kotzebue was followed by, I don't know the exact English word, it's the Karlsbader Beschlüsse in Germany. And it really, really oppressed the civilization and was followed by the Biedermeier thing and so on. But what I wanted to ask is, was there in Great Britain anything similar to that? Was there any oppression by the politics, especially after the massacre?
Fantastic. Yeah. Well, yes is the answer to that. I mean, the Six Acts immediately follows Peterloo, and the Six Act essentially criminalizes people gathering in assemblies. It's already a period where habeas corpus is a vindigazaka, as you would say. It's been lifted in the 1790s. It's lifted again in 1817. It's a very repressive period. It's a period of wide infiltration of coteries and crowds by spies, infiltrators. A lot of Romantic literature meditates on this, often in oblique ways, because to say it openly was dangerous. You ended up in prison like Lee Hunt. It is an oppressive period, and the first thing the state does is a series of repressive legal measures aimed at preventing anything like Peterloo happening again. Not the violence, but the crowd activism.
Okay, then we had a question from the other side of the room, but the lady... A couple of questions. I'll start with the first one.
My question, it's more like asking to elaborate on the part about the soft policing, because I don't think there's much more being talked about that here, and I think it's really good to bring that up, because I think that's a really, really dangerous current that has been going on for a long time, as you said. But developments now, like, just questions of how, what we can do to, like, avoid this kind of detection, this kind of analysis, and where there's more information on this, really.
Well, you have strong views about CCTV in Britain, for example.
Yeah, we have, Britain is the country where, in the world, with the most CCTV cameras and private CCTV cameras all over the, per head, really, and the drones where we're just 20 kilometers up from, are basically just trying to find out new techniques where they can go into crowds, follow individuals, follow groups of crowds. They have this visual analysis technique where they where they're able to pass one group, intermerging with others, and then dispersing again. And especially in crowd systems or crowd situations like demonstrations, protests, this will be very useful for the police. And that's all been tested just below where we are.
And the first police drone that we used to monitor crowds.
Oh yeah, in Liverpool.
Actually, it was Liverpool. And actually, the first velocipedes often went into duck ponds, according to that cartoon. But the first police drone used for that ended up in the River Mersey. But in terms of what you can do about it, it cracks us up, because there's the argument, as soon as you start talking about killer robots, people will say, yes, but drones do very useful things. And they do. Aberystwyth University, where we're from, drones are used to measure nitrogen levels in fields. They use
count sheep.
Transferable skill set there. Lots of things, but it doesn't mean because we have that we have to have killer robots. And actually, the debate is getting going in Britain. CCTV, I think we've become acculturated into it. It's normalised for us. People don't see them. And
they actually advocate for them.
People want them. Yeah. So streets will say, you know, why haven't we got a CCTV camera protecting that wall at the end of our street? Council's very happy to provide them, usually.
Yeah, it seems like a lot of this stuff is the common side of the head. It's getting people to believe that this is good for them and reinforcing that, encouraging them to believe that.
They're there for our safety. That you'll always find those on shields, you know.
Yeah, but then again, I mean, we're both educators. Work in different institutions, and I think our role is being multipliers and also educating anybody that comes across exactly with giving them opposite views.
I teach them in the university. It's too late, but Anna sees them in the further education college, where they're still a little bit more, the brains are a bit more malleable. So, stuff to do there.
Okay.
How much of the problem with policing and over-policing in the Romantic period was due to the fact that the state simply didn't have the right toolbox? I mean, it's important to remember that the people who were sabering down innocent women and children in Peterloo, they weren't police, they were the army. Chelsea Barracks existed to police London because there wasn't a police force.
Yeah, it's an important distinction. They weren't police. They were the yeomanry. It was a paramilitary force, a militia really, and they're poised awkwardly between a regular police force and the army. You're true. So it's paramilitary, but they were used as a police force, the yeomanry in different places.
I mean, the other thing I'd find quite interesting is that you're sort of focusing on urban policing. Mm. How much does this work with more rural policing, and what comes to mind instantly with Wales is the Rebecca riots against toll booths, toll bridges and toll roads.
Yeah, well, you know, we have a proud tradition in Wales stretching back to the Rebecca riots and beyond. And actually Chelsea Manning is could be seen as part of that radical tradition. She had her teenage years in Britain, and you know, there's been a play recently, I think the only major play so far, Tim Price's The Radicalisation of Bradley Manning. It was first put on by the Welsh
Theatre.
National Theatre. Yeah. In terms of wider policing issues, I mean, in actual fact, what the Velocipedes, the first thing the Gentleman's Magazine said, this is great, we can pursue thieves out of the capital into the countryside now. So they were very, very adaptable in the way they saw the potential uses of this technology. I think I lost your question slightly there, but
okay, here we go.
I wanted to say thanks for your talk first. It was really, really great. And also, I guess I've got a point and then a question, if that's all right.
Sure.
The point, I guess, is just more of an elaboration on crowd control policing in the UK today. I think I'm not the only person who was at that protest that you...
Is it you who cheered?
But so it's. I found it really, really interesting that you brought up the lawyers' defences and the idea of just being at a protest or in a protest crowd being not enough for conviction, because now that's basically the definition of the charge of violent disorder, which is the catch-all charge to use to prosecute protesters and people on the streets in the UK right now. But your distinction between being in a crowd and being individuated as part of that crowd is really important, I think, for understanding how crowd control policing works right now, because you can be prosecuted just for being part of that crowd, but at the same time, people are being prosecuted because they've appeared on spotter sites, on police cameras, and from the student riots in 2010, you saw people being picked out of the crowd, you know, people's faces being put up in the newspapers, released by the police. You know, they had 12 pictures for shaming people, mostly young people of colour. And the idea that you can be individuated and picked out, but at the same time prosecuted for being part of a larger movement as a tactic of intimidation. And I guess that was my point. My question was, what is, if you had any more information about what was the reaction to radical art in the Romantic period in terms of a political backlash? Like, what was what was the state's reaction to Shelley and Keats writing all this stuff, because I don't know enough about that.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's those technical processes of de-individuation, and that's what a lot of this technology is supposed to do, and we de-individuate all the time, you know, just by slowing down as we approach a group of people. So it's an excellent point.
Well, the first point, I think, for today, is before you say a part about the Romantics, is there seems to be a difference between the theory, as we've seen in the manuals, the police manuals, and the actual, what they do on the streets. There is this lecturer in Leeds who has very successfully worked with the police in football crowd situations, where he taught the police, and that's where this manual comes from, how to not see a crowd as a mob, as an entity, but see the individuals. And it's worked very successfully in de-escalation techniques and all the rest of it, but it seems like for political protests, nothing of this has been taken into account. So the theory and the reality, it's very disparate there.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's Clifford Stott. I mean, he's doing that research, and it's valuable. And I think it's a really important distinction. You know, stadium crowd and social panic of that kind and protest are seen as very different things. As for the Romantic response to radical art, well, very little in many cases, because the politics was sublimated or sort of displaced onto nature poetry often. So, you know, what looked like a nature poem, pastoral poem, we talked a bit about this last year, is often, you know, in a sort of steganographic way, radical literature that is disguising itself. And that's why it remains such a rich resource, because, you know, we can pick over these things now, and we see those radical agendas and discourses that at the time were purposefully disguised. So the Romantics, in a sense, we can talk about unfinished conversations and continuities.
Yeah. Okay, we have one last question from the internet, our signal angel.
Yeah, so we spoke a lot about the history and the present, but there's also the future, and the question is, do you expect any pre-crime laws in the near future? We already saw those pictures where people like could be indicted, like surveilled in a way, but what can they do with it?
So a Minority Report, predictive policing of that kind. Yeah, well...
Well, they're doing that already, aren't they? Predictive policing.
Yeah, it's very successful. I mean, it'd be disingenuous to suggest that we had all the answers, and certainly Romantic, while it's a rich, you know, the literature and the art is a rich resource, but I'm not quite sure how far into the future we can project, and we've seen the dangers of doing that, those estimated trajectories. I don't know, I mean, my own sense, I think our sense is that autonomous policing and soft policing is raising all sorts of ethical issues, and quite where it's going to go is anybody's guess. But I would guess that it's going that in that direction. Add anything to that?
Okay, I'm sorry, we are a little bit over time, but maybe you will be here for 2 or 3 minutes more if people have more questions from room. Well, Richard and Anne, thank you very much for your talk. Thanks.
Thank you.